D-Radio Wissen. Hörsaal. Der Podcast.
Herzlich willkommen, ich bin Sibylle Salewski.
What's so good about growing up?
I prefer children to adults. Adults too often are boring, egotistical, narcissistic, intolerant, close-mindedly responsible and grotesquely hypocritical. Let's rescue childhood. To fall asleep when you want to make a lot of joyful noise. Rock and roll is essentially childish. To fart and burp when it's natural. To find homework pointless. To notice things properly. To look at them, study them intently for themselves and for no other reason. To lose things the whole time. To ask repeatedly, why do people suffer? I don't want you to die. I want you to live forever. In all this, surely the child is right, and we grow up or away from this childlike posture at peril to our souls.
Wir bringen unsere Seele in Gefahr, wenn wir aufhören, wie Kinder zu sein. Das ist eine ziemlich starke Behauptung, die der New Yorker Literaturkritiker James Wood da aufstellt. Er meint es ernst, aber er will auch ein wenig provozieren. Denn sein Vortrag ist eine Gegenrede, und zwar eine Gegenrede zu dem Vortrag der Philosophin Susan Neiman, den wir gestern bei uns im Hörsaal gesendet haben. Neiman argumentiert, dass es sich lohnt, erwachsen zu werden. James Wood sieht das ganz anders. Nein, sagt er, ich will euch zeigen, wie wichtig es ist, Kind zu bleiben. Denn jede Aufforderung, doch erwachsen zu werden, die lässt sich instrumentalisieren. James Wood schreibt für die Zeitschrift The New Yorker und ist ein erfolgreicher Schriftsteller. Sein Vortrag heißt The Case Against Growing Up und ist ein kleines literarisches Wunderwerk. Heute gibt es bei uns im Hörsaal dann noch einen zweiten Vortrag, in dem erzählt die Historikerin Diana Pinto, was es bedeutet, erwachsen zu werden, ohne eine Heimat zu haben. James Wood hat seinen Vortrag am 13. Juni 2015 gehalten im Einstein-Forum in Potsdam auf der Tagung Why Grow Up.
I want to talk against growing up. I don't want to make an argument. Indeed, I'm not even sure I can make one. I want to disrupt an argument. I want to enact a piece of anarchy. I want to run the risk of not making a great deal of sense, all in the interest of childish irresponsibility. The reason I can't make a proper argument is that Susan's book is clearly right. That's why I'm not joking when I say that her book is about not growing up, because my idea of not growing up will often sound like her idea of growing up. For instance, her admiration for Rousseauian rebellion, or her argument about how travel returns us to a state of childlike wonder, or her obvious love of children generally. What then, in this spirit of enacted anarchy, is my difference with the title of this conference? Briefly, I think it's important to keep open a space for the purely negative, the purely irresponsible, the purely childlike. We live in a rampantly utilitarian and instrumental age when everything we hold dear is in danger of being put to use, made to work for our success, financial or ethical. A many-headed monster, part pragmatism, part neuroscience, part evolutionary biology, part social science, part technology, roars for blood while spewing data at us. You read fiction, then justify it by proving, with the help of MRI machines, that fiction makes you more empathetic. You believe in God? Then science will either tell you that prayer has been proven to have healing powers, or evolutionary psychology will tell you that you are hardwired to believe in an illusory God or gods. You teach the humanities? Then don't be surprised if the government starts ranking universities and departments by how much its graduates are earning by the age of 25. A newish movement called the quantified self offers to incorporate technology and wearable sensors so that all aspects of a person's daily life will be measured and processed: food intake, mood arousal, mental performance, blood oxygen, and so on. Doubtless, future technology will allow for the proper measuring of our daily dose of 3 minutes of empathetic Chekhov reading. We live in an age when a well-known Harvard professor of psychology, a popular expert on happiness, can advertise for prudential retirement funds on television, and no one is very surprised or shocked about it. Ah, thank you. Let's make happiness work for us. Susan's book contains several important warnings about just such a culture of instrumentalism and utilitarian pragmatism. Every fibre of her politics and ethics is set on edge by the crudities and more of this culture. Still, again in my anarchist, with my anarchist hat on, isn't there a danger that noble arguments about the importance of being properly grown up, about enlightenment and good citizenship, might get co-opted by this world precisely because they too are useful? That notions of growing up can be put to work, made to yield whatever we consider politically or ethically desirable. To try to keep a space open for anti-enlightenment, for what is not noble, not especially philosophical, certainly not grown up, not usable, seems important and all the more precious if I can keep my category from also being put to use. In this spirit, one asks, what's so good about growing up? Fuck the laudable ideologies, as Philip Roth's sublimely irresponsible character Mickey Sabbath puts it. I find Susan's book moving and wise about how growing up involves coming into a realization that the world is not right, that it has a gaping metaphysical wound in its side. As we develop, we find that the world is not as it ought to be, that there is a crucial gap between is and ought. Susan rightly says that successful maturity involves negotiating a balance in this tension. To accept the world as it is might result in adult fatalism or cynicism. To be permanently surprised at how the world is, not what it should be, is to be a moral child, a Peter Pan. We need to find what she calls the indignation that, when properly guided, will be needed to make a life active, close quotes. I find this true and moving, personally appealing, because I was that very adolescent, a 16-year-old raised in an intensely Christian environment who stopped believing in God because the world could not be reconciled with any conception I could find of God, because the answers of theodicy all seemed fatally lacking. Still, with my anarchist boots on, my demolition man's Doc Martens, I'm tempted to ask, what if we refuse the very notion of balance, of productive indignation, of properly guided anger at the suffering and pain and inequality of the world? What about unproductive rage instead? A permanent unfulfilled disappointment? What if instead of a proper response, we dared the improper one of returning our ticket, as Ivan Karamazov does, a posture of ceaseless metaphysical complaint? For instance, there may well be a hidden normative theological agenda behind the very notion of growing up. The child discovers a wound. In order to carry on, in order to grow up and not commit suicide or murder God, the child has to find some way of coming to terms with this wound, whereby even one's righteous and rightful indignation is essentially an accommodation of it. One learns to live with this wound even as one shouts against it. Or one comes to believe that the wound can be, if never closed up, patched here and there in gestures of piecemeal political meliorism. More likely, this would include most of us, and alas me, we simply shut our eyes, more or less, to the existence of the wound. Never better phrased than in that great passage in George Eliot's novel Middlemarch, where she says, if we were truly alive to the roar on the other side of silence, if we could hear all the suffering, we couldn't continue to live. And so she says, what we do is we go around well wadded with stupidity. We close our eyes to it. Or more perniciously, we believe that the wound can be religiously healed, perhaps by the promise of justice or restitution in an afterlife, or by the promise that the wound, though currently incomprehensible, is not incomprehensible to its creator. Growing up, seen through this admittedly sinister lens, could resemble a form of theodicy, or a way of accommodating oneself for theodicy, softening oneself up for theodicy. This is not Susan's project. Again, she fairly explicitly rules it out. But it does seem to have been Rousseau's, for whom she has much admiration. Those of us fascinated but alienated by Rousseau tend to feel that he is always conducting a theodicy, always trying to complain about and finally heal the world for natural religion. Susan, if I'm right, quotes Kant on how Rousseau was the Newton of the mind, but not his statement about Rousseau, how Rousseau had finally justified God, had finally produced a convincing theodicy, quote, the secret law whose observation justifies providence. All is good as it leaves the hands of the author, capital A, auteur, all is good as it leaves the hands of the author of things, all degenerates in the hands of man, is the first line of Emile. Rousseau is always trying in one way or another to solve the problem of a fall, in which God is absolved of responsibility, because famously he didn't believe in original sin, and blame ascribed to man. It's not always clear how the fall from nature can be ascribed to man if man is good in his original state. The second discourse, already insanely hypothetical, becomes especially fuzzy when Rousseau tries to explain how good natural man started a process of corruption he is supposedly not responsible for. And there are phrases like the chance coming together of several unconnected causes that might never have come into being, or the various chance happenings that were able to perfect human reason while deteriorating the species, and so on. Rousseau transfers the task of theodicy from metaphysics to ethics and politics. What's exciting and truly dangerous and radical and relentless about Rousseau, his search for theodicy, is also what I find dangerous and relentless and conservative about Rousseau, his certainty that he's found one. And though his novel treatise, Émile, has remarkable insights and contains much rebellion, it's also, let's not forget, about preparing a boy for theodicy, for living in a world that came from the hands of an all-knowing author creator. It's true that, as Starobinsky remarks, that if for Rousseau history creates evil, then the restoration of goodness is to rebel against history and against the present historical situation. This could well be the Rousseau of permanent rebellion, and is probably closer to Susan's ideal philosopher. But I see instead a philosopher who does indeed believe also in restoration, whose notion of rebellion is about doing battle with the social world so that it restores itself metaphysically or theologically. If you doubt that this is a religious view of things, compare it with St. Paul's vision of growing up, and you see where, as it were, Rousseau began, and where, as it were, he might be used to end up. For Paul, the law is bad. That's the second discourse. But the law we choose for ourselves, the social contract, Christian law, is good. For Paul, a wound opened up when we exiled ourselves from Eden, or Rousseau's natural state. And the Christian has the chance to heal that wound by doing it all again, this time properly and in spiritual form. Paul, of course, is the ultimate theodicist. Eternal life restores and heals the wound, binds together the awful gap between is and ought. But you could also make the case that Paul is the great rebel, the militant saint of permanent revolution, the Rousseauian for whom human society is corruption and vice and transient dross, all to be swept away and eternally corrected. Paul shows us that social rebellion is not necessarily incompatible with order, or at least divine order. It simply depends on your definition of order. And it's Paul, of course, who tells us to put away childish things. When I was a child, I spoke as a child, I understood as a child, I thought as a child, but when I became a man, I put away childish things. This, you'll remember, is his analogy for how we will finally see God. At present, we see him darkly, in parts. When we see God face to face, we shall, he implies, no longer be spiritual children, but fully grown up. We're perhaps reminded how ambivalent the Christian tradition is in its relation to children. Jesus rebukes his disciples for trying to stop children coming to him and reminds them that whoever does not receive the kingdom of God as a little child shall not enter it. But the Jesus who is never seen laughing, he weeps, we are told, but does not laugh, is never seen engaging, of course, with children. Children to be used as analogies, as images of innocence, or when later theology dictates, as images of inherited corruption. I'm thinking of Augustine's famous conclusion that unbaptized children would have to go to hell. They are exemplary, not truly free. The important thing to note is that Paul's idea of putting away childish things isn't incompatible with Jesus' remark about how we enter heaven as children. Indeed, we do, in order that we be transformed into proper spiritual pupils, and finally, spiritual adults. Of course we must be children to enter heaven. We're being softened up, the ultimate, the final theodicy. It's interesting to see how Paul's narrative is appropriated by late 18th and 19th century secularism, so that education out of religion and into secular enlightenment is also seen as putting away childish things. The deconversion narratives, the loss of faith narratives of the 19th century, some of which, of course, find their way into the Bildungsroman, are narratives about growing up out of childish credulity and naivety. The subject, Tocqueville, Jane Eyre, Nuthamsen, in the 20th century, John Rawls even, has his or her crisis of faith in youth, and partly because of maturation, and grows out of superstition and naive magic. It's a common insult now in atheistic circles to call the religious believer childish, a naif clinging to childish consolations. I like this narrative little more than I like its religious template, and because it too closely resembles the religious narrative. Once again, childhood is put to use, made exemplary. Let's rescue childhood from both the religious narrative and the secular narrative that's mimicking a religious narrative. Here I shall be at my most purely assertive, romantic, negationist, and anarchistic. On balance, I prefer children to adults and mistrust those adults who have lost connection with their childishness. I find myself in agreement with Karl Ove Knausgård, who in volume 2 of his memoir, My Struggle, writes funnily about the tedium of having to attend, as parents, all those boring children's birthday parties. Yes, suggests Knausgård, they are boring. But it's the adults who are really tedious, with their pointless small talk, that very category that children find utterly incomprehensible, with their pointless small talk about what route they took to drive to the party and how excellent their new televisions are. Adults too often are boring, egotistical, narcissistic, intolerant, close-mindedly responsible, and grotesquely hypocritical. The childish impulse is more often right than the grown-up impulse, with a few life-saving exceptions. To be bored in class, to play under the table while grown-ups are conducting their interminable meals, to fall asleep when you want to make a lot of joyful noise. Rock and roll is essentially childish. To fart and burp when it's natural. Remember that Tolstoy says our fear of death is like our fear of making a smell in a drawing room. To find homework pointless, to be faithful to friends without needing to theorize that fidelity, to fundamentally fail to understand instrumentalism, to notice things properly, to look at them, study them intently for themselves and for no other reason. To lose things the whole time. To ask repeatedly, why do people suffer? Why is that man striking that dog? Why do people believe in God? Is there a God? I don't want you to die. I want you to live forever. In all this, surely the child is right, and we grow up or away from this childlike posture at peril to our souls. It's painful to watch my 13-year-old daughter becoming schooled, literally and figuratively, in the false laws of adulthood, the meaningless obligations, the black slip she gets if she's late, the foolish exams, the knowledge she has to absorb only to have forgotten it all by the time she's 18. She's being groomed for work, for that category of adulthood that Bataille reminds us is where Eros is put away, disciplined, hidden. And as for Eros, it's of course painful to see her becoming aware of sexual corruption. The economy of Eros. How do I look? How am I being seen? The hideous self-consciousness of erotic adulthood. Yes, I know, I'm madly Rousseauian, or rather the rebellious Rousseau and not the conservative one, for I do see growing up as more of a fall than a rising up. I'm reminded of that extraordinary, rather sinister, but also sad moment in Thomas Mann's diaries where he sees his naked children running around in the bedroom and is simply struck, heart-struck, by the beauty and innocence of their bodies. And there's a slightly sinister, leering quality to Mann's commentary. We'll put that aside. But the heart-struck thing of seeing what bodily unself-consciousness is like. And I will also admit that this elegiac romanticism is sentimental, even a little sick, certainly irresponsible, and barely defensible. But, fortunately, a great German, Schiller, goes before me. Remember how, on Simple and Sentimental Poetry, he speaks of nature and how we relate to the trees, the birds, and indeed children. They are, he writes, what we were. They are what we ought to become once more. I'm an elegist and a sick sentimental modern. Well, so be it. Growing up is elegiac. There's a line I love from a wonderful novel by the Norwegian novelist Per Pettersen. The novel is called I Curse the River of Time, itself a sublime title. And in I Curse the River of Time, the hero, who is about 40 and whose mother is dying, cannot stop thinking about his childhood. Indeed, he's paralyzed by his retrospection. Sometimes he says, quote, I would lie in bed awake, and then I would long for my childhood with such teeth-grinding intensity that I almost frightened myself, close quote. Perhaps because I'm now middle-aged, perhaps because my mother died last summer, perhaps because I've now lived for 20 years in America and don't feel any longer connected to England, to the country of my birth, for all these reasons, perhaps, I find myself longing for my childhood with teeth-grinding intensity. Sometimes in bed, a breeze comes in from the open window, and the very breeze, for a reason I cannot specify, the very breeze reminds me of childhood, seems to carry with it the feel and smell of childhood details. I hear a train, an American train, and suddenly I'm back in England, in the north of England, in Durham, where as a child I would hear the big diesel engines pulling out of the station at night time, thundering their way north to Edinburgh or south to London. I remember how fast my mother used to run up the stairs, sometimes drastically so. You would have to put away whatever vice you were engaged in. I remember the free, empty, endless, irresponsible time I spent with my best friend William. I saw William last year at my mother's funeral. We hadn't been in touch for 20 years and found it surprisingly easy to rekindle our friendship. He reminded me of a moment of childish irresponsibility which I'd forgotten about, a day that we took the train to Newcastle and convinced ourselves, through some peculiar argumentation, that we had no obligation whatsoever to pay for the tickets. As I said, indefensible. Growing up is elegiac because growing up involves the awareness of death, of finitude, of ending. In this simple sense, childhood must be better than adulthood. Even if adulthood contains all kinds of complicated pleasures and joys and rights and responsibilities that childhood cannot comprehend or contain. Growing up or living is like the Roman Ave atque vale, both an address and a long farewell, an opening out which is simultaneously a closing off. And of course, logically, if adulthood is both that address and that farewell, so is childhood, at least the beginning of it. But it's just that the farewell is, if you're a fortunate child, so blissfully far away. Is there a way of outwitting death? Figuratively, I mean. One way, of course, might be through what you hand on to your children, to other relatives, to younger friends, or something you make or leave in the world that will outlast you. Another might be that artworks survive. They survive their own periods, and perhaps, if you're very lucky, you might create something like an artwork that survives you. Here I want to add another dimension to this discussion of childishness. What might make sense to the philosopher or the theorist, the researcher, the moralist, the politician, the theologian, the activist, might not make sense to the artist. It seems very important that the artist remains childlike, irresponsible, somehow outside the categories of responsible adulthood, at least in his or her work. I don't mean necessarily as a human being. For a number of reasons. What's good for art isn't necessarily good for society. A world populated by varieties of Dostoevsky's underground man or his 20th century successor, Thomas Bernhardt's ranting monologists, would be unbearable and quite possibly dangerous. But we need the category of the underground man so that we have the possibility of pure negation. The point about the underground man is that he is unworkable. He makes no sense. And one of the complexities of that short book is that Dostoevsky both strongly identifies with his negating rebel and shows us that he is confused, incoherent, laughable. The novel is fundamentally, I mean the novel form, a secular and comic form, and as such, it's always proposing alternative, hypothetical, often impossible ways of being. Indeed, I find it notable that the great comic novels of irresponsibility, Don Quixote, The Good Soldier Shfike, Confessions of Zeno, Oblomov, don't really want to end and find the business of ending difficult. This is perhaps generally beautifully true of the novel. Its secular impulse is towards expanding and extending life. The novel is the great trader in the shares of the ordinary. It expands the instances of our lives into scenes and details. It tries to run these scenes at a rhythm close to real time. It wants its characters to live forever, can't understand why they must die. This is partly why many readers find that the last 50 pages of novels are so annoying. all that busy machinery, the deus ex machina dropping down to tie up the loose ends and kill off the characters or marry them. Ending is disappointing. Remember how reluctantly and almost casually Cervantes says farewell to his Don Quixote, who has been on his deathbed and who has at the last moment renounced his knight errantry, itself a horrible and completely incomprehensible embrace of growing up and rightly rejected by most sensible readers. Don't die, senor mio, is Sancho's tearful response. Don Quixote makes his will, lives another 3 days, and then, quote, amidst the tears and lamentations of everybody present, gave up the ghost, by which I mean to say he died, close quote. The poverty of the language, its near clumsiness and refusal to expand into sentiment, is very moving, as if Cervantes himself was surprised by the event and is overcome with wordless grief at the passing of his creation. And there's another way, perhaps, in which the childlike artist outwits death, by noticing the world, by seeing it with innocent eyes, and by creating details that keep alive some of the forgotten pungency of childhood textures. Perhaps writers do nothing less than rescue the life of things from their death, from two deaths, one small and one large, from the death that literary form always threatens to impose on life. What I mean by that is that way in which details seem to stick out of texts, and they're the things you remember after most of the form of the novel has been forgotten. From the small death of literary form and from actual death. By the latter, actual death, I mean the fading reality that besets details as they recede from us, the memories of our childhood, the almost forgotten power of flavors, smells, textures, the slow death we deal to the world by the sleep of our adult attention. By habit or through laziness, lack of curiosity, haste, we stop looking at things as the child looks at things. Growing older, says Knausgård, clearly the most romantic contemporary writer dealing with this subject, is like standing in front of a mirror while holding another mirror behind one's head and seeing the receding dance of images becoming smaller and smaller as far as the eye can see. Knausgård's world is one in which the adventure of the ordinary, the inexhaustibility of the ordinary as a child once experienced it, the taste of salt that could fill your summer days to saturation, is steadily retreating, in which things and objects and sensations are pacing toward meaninglessness. I think he romantically, elegiacally overstates the case, not least because his own work demonstrates how well the adult, the childlike adult, can recover the lost meaning. He brings meaning, color, and life back to the most ordinary things in his work, to soccer boots and grass, to cranes and trees, and airports. Quote, you could still buy Slazenger tennis rackets, Treton balls and Rossignol skis, Tiroka bindings and Koflak boots. The houses where we lived were still standing, all of them. The sole difference, which is the difference between a child's reality and an adult's, was that they were no longer laden with meaning. I'm continuing the quote. A pair of Le Soc football boots was just a pair of football boots. If I felt anything when I held a pair in my hands now, it was only a hangover of my childhood, nothing else, nothing in itself. The same with the sea, the same with the rocks, the same with the taste of salt that could fill your summer days to saturation. Now it was just salt, end of story. The world was the same, yet it wasn't, for its meaning had been displaced and was still being displaced, approaching closer and closer to meaninglessness. As I say, he overstates the case. Why doesn't he commit suicide? But surely it's no surprise that we so often remember details that concern the deaths of real people, famous last words and so on, or the details that attend the deaths of fictional characters. Isn't this because at such moments, writers are snatching the details of life and the life of details from the extinction that surrounds and threatens them? I'm thinking of certain fond memories I have, say, of Montaigne's essay on cruelty, where he talks about, there's a superb detail about, a very novelistic, modern detail, it would seem, about Socrates adjusting the shackle on his leg for comfort. And Montaigne says, you know, by doing this, he showed a freedom, he exemplified a freedom that he would take into life after death. The novelistic version of that would be the famous moment in War and Peace where Pierre is about to be executed by the French, and sees a man next to him with a blindfold on, pointlessly adjust the blindfold for comfort, for ease, a second before death. That's the life surplus, pushing itself beyond death. Think again of Tolstoy, of Ivan Illich. As he nears his death at the moment of greatest loneliness, he remembers the French plums of his childhood and the way that when you got down to the pit of the fruit, the saliva would flow. When Bellow's character Moses Herzog sees lobsters behind the glass of a Manhattan fishmonger, he sees their feelers bent, pressed up against the glass, the complaint of life against its deathly imprisonment. When the contemporary American novelist Rachel Kushner sees a squashed cockroach on a New York sidewalk, she notices its long, wispy antennae swiping around for signs of its own life. To notice is to redeem, to rescue, to save life from itself. One of the characters in Marilyn Robinson's novel, Housekeeping, is described as a girl who felt the life of perished things. In the same book, Marilyn Robinson writes of how Jesus raised Lazarus from the dead and even restored the severed ear of the soldier who came to rescue him. A fact, she says, that allows us to hope that resurrection will reflect a considerable attention to detail. I like the idea that heaven, if I only believed in it, must therefore be a place of serious, writerly noticing. But perhaps we can extend life here on earth by doing the same, by applying what Walter Benjamin once called the natural prayer of the soul, attentiveness. Benjamin's phrase comes in a letter to Adorno about Kafka. Perhaps Adorno was recalling this idea of attentiveness when he wrote in Negative Dialectics that if the thought really yielded to the object, if its attention were on the object, not on its category, the very objects would start talking under the lingering eye. There are two famous Glenn Gould recordings of the Goldberg Variations. The one he made at the age of 22, and the one he made at 51, just before he died. The opening aria of that piece, the lucid, ornate melody that Gould made his own, sounds very different in each recording. In the young man's version, the aria is fast, sweet, almost skipping, running clear like water. In the middle-aged man's recording, the aria is half as fast, takes twice as long, the notes so magnetically separated that they seem almost unrelated to each other. Probably slower than that, indeed. The first is cocky, childlike, exuberant, optimistic, vital, sound-filled. The second is reflective, seasoned, wintry, grieving, silence-haunted. These two arias stand facing each other, separated by almost 30 years, as the gates of a life. I prefer the second version, as it happens. It moves me more. But when I listen to the second, how I want to be the first. Thank you.
Das war der Literaturkritiker James Wood über den Zauber des Kindseins. Wie schwer es sein kann, diesen Zauber zu bewahren, davon erzählt Diana Pinto in ihrem Vortrag Growing Up Under Different Skies. Pinto blickt auf ihre eigene Kindheit zurück und beschreibt, warum es für Migranten und Flüchtlinge so schwierig ist, erwachsen zu werden.
I stand before you with all of my contradictions and with the feeling that perhaps what I'm going to talk about is only pertinent to me and perhaps for others, but maybe not as much as one can assume. So bear with me for a while, and if you think I'm really going off into another world, say so, it'll be very interesting. Dominique mentioned my autobiography written at the scandalous age of about 39, but I will only talk about the title. I wanted it to be called in French, l'hybride, the hybrid, on the notion that hybrid plants are very strong. You know, you take one part from another and they can survive droughts or rain or whatever. And my French publisher said, l'hybride, that sounds awful. You have to call your book Entre deux mondes. I cannot think of a more banal title if I had to invent one, which also makes you think of Between Two Stools. I'm sorry she did not accept the hybrid because I think we live in hybrid times and it would have been more appropriate. I also have a major confession to make at the very beginning, and I hope I don't shock you, especially not all my friends from Harvard and Cambridge. I started thinking again about this topic after the Boston Marathon terrorist attacks. And when the lives of the two Tsarnaev brothers were described, once they had been identified as the murderers, I had a disturbingly strange feeling that I felt I understood them. And by this, don't take me wrong, I'm not about ready to throw bombs, but there was something in the anguish and identity of that path that I personally could understand. And they carried within them an anguish that I perhaps shared. And I find it extremely symbolic that they chose to murder with a pressure cooker, because it seems to me that the pressure cooker inside them exploded before they took a pressure cooker outside. And it is something about these pressure cookers that we now have around the world, call them French jihadists, British terrorists in London, wherever they may be, whose pressure from inside, I will try to explain, or at least try to understand as a rather peaceful person, given the anger that comes from not really belonging anywhere, and therefore being born or growing up under different skies. Now, don't take me wrong, one of the questions I have here is, the skies must be different. And maybe I'm being unfair. If you grow up between Los Angeles and Houston, might it make a great difference? I'm thinking of rather more different skies. And my question I do ask myself is whether this particular problem is symbolic in its extreme form of other growing up problems, or whether it's a special category on its own. I don't know, and I rely on you to tell me when I finish this small presentation. What did strike me about the Tsarnaev brothers was the mother back in Chechnya screaming out anti-Americanism, telling them about the fact that the Muslims, their brothers, were being destroyed, that they were sitting in America, and they themselves in America not fully able to play out the American dream, unlike some of their family members, which the FBI immediately interrogated, but who were wonderful middle-class Americans saying, we have absolutely nothing to do with those guys out there. And something about the burning anguish that probably animated them, although I realized that Misha Gessen had written a book saying that, you know, nothing had really happened until the FSB or somebody in Russia had decided to pick up and give them checks so that they could be active. So, whatever. What I'm trying to see is that how do you live when you've had different skies in your childhood? When you get different skies as an adult or as a very young adult, it's thrilling, it's fascinating, it's wonderful. Obviously, their extreme case was terribly, something went terribly wrong. Many people growing up under different skies are confused, hurt, ill at ease, despite the chic trappings, even despite the fact that they can make coherent arguments or analyses most of the time if they've chosen an intellectual way of life. They're never quite at home. And when you find a similar soul, there's a kind of silence or immediate understanding that takes place saying, well, it's only me or part of me here. You know as much as I do that there's another part out there we can't quite grasp and it doesn't fit in that given room. Is growing up under different skies so different than in a static place? I would think so. And the question is worth pondering, because never have we had so many people growing up under different skies as today. The number of refugees today in the world has reached World War II proportions. They're migrants, they're shuttlers, they're employers, they are incredibly different reasons for people to be moving about. And when I watch them on those boats on the way to Lampedusa, or wherever else, as they're fished out from the Mediterranean or now from the South Pacific Ocean, I think of them and I think of their children. And I know that somewhere, despite the success of the Vietnamese boat people, who can make fantastic careers, many of them will grow up with an inner tension that might be resolved perhaps through psychoanalysis or may not be. When you grow up in such circumstances, there's always the question of the road not taken, the language not perfected, the soul that does not necessarily square with one's environment. And I don't mean in sociological or cultural terms, but in metaphysical terms of attention within. Worse still, there are those who are not allowed to fit in their environment. And I come to mind a young man who, in a conference I was giving in London about 15 years ago, he was of East Asian origin, who told me that he loved the grey skies and the green fields around Birmingham. And he told me, "I feel so much at ease in a Constable painting, but they won't allow me to think of it as my own." Consequently, another major cleavage when others do not consider that you're worthy of sharing that particular moment. So how does one grow up under different skies? There are many different ways. There's a sojourner in another land who with a family or someone goes for work reasons and comes back home. There's the diplomat, perhaps the easiest category of all, whose children are kept in the identity and carry with them their own protective shell, not unlike turtles, and may enjoy the exoticism of their parents' posting, but not much more. More seriously, there's the refugee, loading on and moving for the basics of life in a place where you won't be killed or destroyed by injustice in our epoch has turned them into our heroes, I would like to think. But no one seems to think that they are heroes despite the anguish, the courage it takes to get on one of those boats or on one of those trucks to London. And they all speak English, they're highly educated, and they should not be treated as the cattle or the poor scum of the earth, the way they're treated, I think, is one of the most shocking things to happen. The immigrant looking for a better world to make it. The expatriate implies luxury, a choice of home to go back to, or simply not caring. Then there's a cosmopolitan. Do we still have them? A happy few capable to switch from one culture to the other. Where are the ones who grow up with the different skies? And more important, what are the issues at stake? We all have to define ourselves with respect to our parents. What if the parents are not similar? Or what if they are and they come from the old world? And what if they don't send the same signals to their children? What if there are cultural or political or existential divisions between the parents? I'm not even talking about the religious ones that might exist. Are the parents going to be integrated? Do they feel marginal? Must the children take on the responsibility of fulfilling their parents' role? Or the unfulfilled promises or the hopes? What about the schooling? Try imagining having to change 5 or 6 schools and having to make new friends when you're 7, 8, or 9. It is very difficult. It's a moment of anguish that forms, perhaps, one's adult life. Finding a mate, that's later on in life. Are you fulfilling a previous dream? Are you trying something new? Are you going the opposite direction? Something of that old problem of living under different skies remains and doesn't go away quite easily. Thomas Wolfe had said that you couldn't go home again, but those growing up in different skies can. There is still a home somewhere, or a place, or a city, or a place. So there is this notion, what if I'd gone in that way rather than? So what are the possible solutions for such people? Well, there's the push for integration, assimilation, disappear, and pretend nothing of this has happened. It was difficult for immigrants. Now, if you're black or Asian in some places, it's much more difficult to disappear. But even the Jews were not that good at it. Then there are places in which you can integrate more or less. Some countries want you to disappear and integrate and forget who you are. And the French Republic and France, where I live, are one of those countries. And you can play at it rather well, even if you're black or of Moroccan origin. Secondly, of course, there's the push for rebellion, often turned into the violence of the Tsarnaev brothers, based on the hatred of a society that won't really have you. You explode from within, although this is not a good metaphor given the fact that people have taken to exploding in the last few decades, unfortunately. Then there's the push toward a collective identity as a member of a subgroup, we inside a bigger them, which is somewhat different compared to the I against you that most children have to go through, all of us, in order to become an adult. The group becomes you, and you embrace it. It is an alienation in terms of the self and the I that has to come out of this long process. Then there could be the push toward detachment and solitude, an ironical stance. It creates perhaps great artists and intellectuals, but whether the group is such people who take for this option are really happy is an entirely different story. Finally, there is perhaps the push for a calmer understanding, a selective belonging, while also appreciating the multiple identities. But is it so feasible? And is that perhaps becoming an adult? It takes a long time, and you mellow into it. Faute de mieux. All of these things can perhaps apply to anybody, anywhere, the person in Kansas who's never left Kansas. But there's a special pain or echo to them when the skies change all of a sudden. So there is this problem with the tension, with the family environment, with the society, with the schools, with the friends, with the path to take, with the career to take. Psychology and politics are intertwined. You never quite know if it's a really political choice or a psychological one. Finally, there's an element here of the language. It is the crucial element, the unmastered other. What language are you growing up under different skies? Where is the real soul? Are you schizophrenic? What are you saying where? And this is to be very personal. People feel that I'm extremely lucky because I speak three languages perfectly. Most of the time I tell them, yes, I master them at 98%. But there's many a day in which I really would love to have one language, 100%. And what do I mean by that? That my toenails, all the way up to my hair, have been lived in one language so that I can have the dialectical understanding of myself that comes with verbs that are conjugated in all sentences and all forms and all modes, and I don't have that missing 2%. So the problem of language is not an easy one to go away. And most of the people who go back to the other sky have to learn the language if they haven't been lucky enough to master it because of schooling. Now, there's a good happy ending, perhaps. You know, the children, you make them speak a language at home, but then they're socialized and they will speak something else. And slowly, with generations as they go down, that issue of language will disappear, and the 100% or whatever, they'll have 100% plus another language. And so maybe growing up under different skies has the redeeming value that at some point only one sky will predominate in the family history, and all I'm telling you about right now will just dissolve. So this is why I stand before you with great angst, because it's maybe one generational story, and even then someone of my age and the 30-year-olds who can travel from XYZ and have professorships wherever they want in this new world may not even have this particular thing. When you grow up with such divided souls, is there just a us and a them, a you and a me? How does the I emerge, and when does it emerge? Is it an easy path? Perhaps more difficult than elsewhere. The concentric circles of life are clashing one with another. You have the internal family one, the school one, the university one, perhaps grandparents, perhaps the echo of this dream of a country elsewhere. And then there's another element, which is hard to quantify, and it's what I would call the issue of thwarted pride. It's not pride about yourself, but you find yourself defending the others, wherever they may be, in the name of you don't understand them, there's more to them than meets the eye. How dare you say this about that? As a child, I was very susceptible in defending the Italians because, you know, they were looked upon, spat upon, laughed upon. And I just went like this. Then I had to defend the Americans when I moved to France. And then the French, well, they can handle themselves. But I mean, sometimes I have to defend them now because of what's happening in France. So this thwarted, misplaced pride, it is always nagging at you because you have to take it into account because you feel you're speaking also for other people than just yourself. And this misplaced collective pride can lead to terrorism. It can lead to whatever you call. And it's something that someone who has only grown up under one sky, you can hate America, love, leave it, you know, whatever, hate this other country and leave it. But being stuck in a mudwater of thwarted prides is a very strange thing that I think only really when you mellow ends. So, how do you grow up in such circumstances? All right, a few positive endings here. Accept complexity while curbing pain. That really takes a lot of work. Multiple belonging against a desire to belong. Accept the familial choices and then transcend them. The most difficult part of the two that come, create your own internal compass, and maybe it's the magnetic pole that's complicated and it oscillates too much nowadays. Or choose your own longitude and latitude. Not easy. Pick and choose while also understanding. The ability to stand outside in oneself or jumping in. Generally, one does one or the other. How to learn how to jump in and also stay a bit outside. Do you wish to become a bridge or a dam? Very difficult choice. Bridges, somebody's got to hold them on both sides. The dam, it's always susceptible to being swamped by water. And is this easy? No. But I assume that that is what is growing up when you have to move under different skies as a child. But there are demands that are made. And now the demands are made to the Muslims of the Western world. Look, if you want to be our Muslim, you have to stand up and criticize the horrors. You have to show that you may be Muslim, but you're really 100% French or 100% American or 100% British. And is it so easy to be done in this conflicting sky element? What happens if you're not accepted, if you say, yes, but it's complicated, I'm against death and terrorism. But, you know, somehow my heart vacillates. We are not very good at accepting vacillating hearts. And this is also now coming like, we love you as Jews, but really to be a Jew amongst ourselves, you've got to start criticizing Israel with a capital C and every day. And this is a phenomena that I think most of the people who may be Jewish would understand. Can one grow as an individual and as a member of a community? It's a schizophrenic proposition, and I know there are psychiatrists here, but I have been told by someone that schizophrenics today are told as a way of redeeming or explaining their condition, look, you've got one more dimension than everybody else, so just remember that. They're lacking your other voices, so please just tone down and speak to these people with the voices that they can hear, and you keep your other voices for yourself and be very creative. I think that might be one of the elements about this whole thing. So you go out into the world and you speak with the voices that people can hear. And sometimes the others are interesting, but they're not really most of the time because people are not equipped to understand them. Is this perhaps the ultimate condition of growing up under different skies? You keep things of yourself to yourself and others are made much more public. Can there be a fellowship of such multiple people? I don't know. Maybe. I see great comfort in the fact that the younger people across Europe, since I'm old, are flocking towards me, the new immigrants, the German Turks, the Muslims in France, Southeast Asians in London, saying, oh, you mean you've been through this already? We thought this was our own sort of post-colonial dark-skinned problem or not European. Oh, this is wonderful. So in a sense, the younger generation has given me an incredible possibility to feel much better because I become like a kind of Moses into the chaotic skies. All right, so let me just leave you with these questions. And I just want to say that I find solace in what I learned recently was an old Normandy proverb. We have a house in Normandy. I'm Italian by birth. So I always grew up knowing that skies were blue in the summer. I also, when I first went to Holland, when I must have been 14, it was the end of August, and I saw people running around with raincoats and woolen scarves, and I said, but they're just walking as though it were normal. Don't they realize something must have happened that just, how can they look so normal when it's the 20th of August, the skies are not blue, and it's so bitterly cold? I knew nothing about those parts of the world. And the Normans define such an Italian sky, the blue sky with no clouds, the one everyone aspires to go to in the summer, they have a term for it. It's called a stupid sky, un ciel stupide. And when I heard one of the elders say, oh, aujourd'hui, un ciel stupide, I couldn't understand. And now I've realized that growing up for me has come to mean that I look for the clouds, the movements, the storm, and the clouds again and again, and not the stupid sky.
Das war die Historikerin Diana Pinto über das Erwachsenwerden als Migrant oder Flüchtling. Sie hat ihren Vortrag am 13. Juni 2015 im Einstein-Forum in Potsdam gehalten, im Rahmen der Tagung Why Grow Up.
Die Radio Wissen, Hörsaal. Samstag und Sonntag von 18 bis 19 Uhr.